little jazz age there. Yes, it's Sunday afternoon, and yes, it's time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me in the studio and in various other media today is Carol Novak. Hello, Carol. How are you?
Hello, Jeff. I made it here without a hitch.
Excellent, excellent. Carol is a brand new driver and is navigating her way successfully around and about Asheville. That's excellent.
Yeah, it's challenging.
It is challenging because Asheville is actually laid out in a kind of random way.
And the signs are atrocious.
It's all true. It's all true, yeah. Well, we'll be right back with Carol, but let's listen to, here's a track that Carol has put together for us.
It's on my CD.
For her special CD.
What to do with the babies? I asked Daddy what to do with the babies. They were flying around my bedroom looking for a breast. I was looking as well. You can tell what babies need when you listen to their breathing. As usual, I could not sleep. I could sense the moon behind the dense curtains. I knew I had no breast, and the moon was not mine. I wanted to understand my babies, and the moon was not my breast. The babies were fish with gills like wings. They were moving in circles. Daddy returned with a butterfly net. I was afraid he'd bruise the babies, he with his voice like bagpipes, eyes urgent bees, looking at me as if I had a breast. Be gentle, Daddy. I spoke gradually in a voice that felt far away, like a fish sleeping on the bottom of a deep pond. I lay on my bed, exhaling fast, a fish in shallow water. He saw that when he turned the flashlight on my face. I was afraid I'd scream like five saxophones, so I didn't. His bee eyes stung, but I asked again, what should we do with the babies? Daddy usually liked me when I asked him questions. This time, he realized I knew he had no answers. He held the net like a baseball bat, swung the net and swooped. He caught my face so I could barely gasp. He caught my face and the baby circled faster and faster around the black globe on the ceiling, pleading, at least light, if not breast. I whispered, wait. Daddy whispered, baby. The babies are in the wash. Where else could I put them? Never mind you, now without teeth, memory all over the place, nothing to tell me. Just know I must feed the laboring men. They will come after. They've herded the animals into barns, pens, and stables. They will come stomping in boots like rocks and sit around this table here, tipsy from hunger, wanting moonshine, my breast, waiting to be fed. It is not easy to know what to do with the babies when the laborers clamor for moonshine. What to do when the babies clamor. I watch the men with their ravenous bee eyes, faces hardened cement. They will lasso the babies if I don't keep watch, and they will devour them. Into those full mouths they will go. I pour moonshine into the wash to quiet the babies so the men won't hear their breathing. I ought to put them in a burlap bag, says Daddy. Put them in a bag and drown them in moonshine. Daddy sat at the table with his head in his lap, hands over his ears. I thought I could hear him crying, but maybe it was the moan of an arriving moon. It was hard to tell with all the babies screaming. What should I do with the babies? Daddy asked himself over and over again, as if nobody was in that room. Nobody was. Nobody was eating the white flesh of the potatoes. Only the brown spots. Somebody always said, those brown spots give you cancer. People say lots of things. If you listen to them, you'll stay under the table with the dogs. Best to put your hands over your ears, I say. Mommy sat there straight up again with her belly full of tumor. She was praying to something merciful. I thought of taking a dart from Pin the Tail on the donkey and bursting her belly. I always thought that way when her belly intruded and she prayed like that. Her belly filled her plate and I wanted to shake the tumor out of her. Poor Daddy with his skinny cows should have locked Mommy in the barn till her stomach was flat. Should have sat on her to keep her that way. There wasn't enough of anything to feed all those babies. Mommy's breasts were hollow inside like Halloween gourds, and the chickens were spitting blood from the rain. All year the sky had spilled bad weather. Surely Mommy knew. The chickens poked their obscene red beaks through the cracks in the windows, wanting radiators. They screamed with the babies. Too much noise. That's the night I decided to open the trap door and live in the fallout shelter.
Fascinating, fascinating. Very interesting, wonderful soundscapes, in addition to a wonderful, provocative text. That's music by Benjamin Rush Miller.
Yeah, correct,
a collaborator of yours. You've collaborated a lot with...
There are a few musicians I've collaborated with. They're brilliant. There's Ben and Bizared Bergenet and Don Meyer.
Right, right.
Yeah, they're all fantastic.
Yeah, we'll hear a track with Don Meyer, I think, a little bit down the road here. Yeah, yeah. So I should say Carol is the former recipient of a Writer's Award from the Australian government, the author of a poetry chapbook, and publisher of Mad Hatter's Review. She's an erstwhile criminal defense and constitutional attorney, GADS. And her blog, what is your blog, Carol? Give us...
CarolNovak.blogspot.com.
CarolNovak.blogspot.com. For links, you'll find links there to publications and interviews. And this is her official bio. There was a long distance to travel back and so much extraneous extravaganza. I think I have lost most parts on the way. Forget where the tail of this life lies, the fortunes and misses, miss what is left, if anything, suspect I may be invisible in the mirrors, may have already misplaced myself, mistaking myself for a metaphor, may or may have forget. There you go. Succinctly put.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, you have so many voices in your work, and you've done work of such variety. Where would you like to start today?
It's difficult. I have some from my... It's very relaxing for me to sit back, and because there are a few on my CD, Inventions, too. And the first you heard, one of them you heard.
Right.
I'll read something, maybe some more recent
pieces. Yeah, sure. Let's start with the present.
The present,
as it were.
President has already gone. I think
yeah,
B.S.
Well,
Eliot
yeah.
said something. As he was eating a peach. This is from Three Holograms, and I'll say that I'm always interested, especially now that I can drive.
Yes. It opens whole new realms.
With my dented fender and my bumper drooping.
That's not bad. Only one accident.
That's right. I didn't kill anyone.
That's right. No fatalities. You're okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
No roadkill either.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good.
So, I mean, I wouldn't mind some of them, you know, the the Rifle Association bumper sticker people.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
This is, I'll start with Coal Dust, which is a serious piece, and its image and socio-politically driven, and I'd say a lot of my work is socio-politically driven. Uh-huh. By that I mean, I'm aware of what's going on in the world, and it scares the shit out of me.
Right, and you react to it, yeah.
And this... I wanted to start out with What to Do with the Babies, because it's very Americana piece. It's about poverty. It's got references to moonshine, and I wrote it a few years ago when I never even imagined I'd live in the Bible Belt.
Yeah, home of moonshine.
But this one is called Coal Dust.
All right. Let's hear it.
Pink paper clouds flutter above Lila's crib, stirred by late summer breezes that swoop down from the mountaintops like vultures, taking us all as we sleep. But we have no idea we're being taken. Yellow birds tangle and tendrils of wire twirl through the clouds above Lila's head, whisper dust of flowers into her translucent ears. She coughs delicately, at first only quivering baby coughs. The coughs grow like tumors invading her baby mouth. Her brain is too new to enunciate pain. It is said that babies cry for many reasons, though we know the reason, even if we cannot utter it. Of course, we can barely articulate our own pain. We are incomprehensible, not comprehending. Wrapped in Egyptian sheets, humid from sweat, Daddy and I sent the discordant waves of air, waves of our daughter's coal black hair, burning. The flames in the heart of the planet rise, creatures disappear, we cannot see or hear them. Comme il faut, their deaths cannot touch us. We cannot feel that far into the significance of weather, into the flesh of species foreign to our homes and hearts. Every night we hear the devil man's tongue wagging, feel his ice hot breath tear through the veins of this house and its residents. Devil man says, "Hoo hoo, hoo hoo," ask so politely, "Who is coming to get you?" Should we listen to the news when it repeats itself like a recurrent nightmare, regurgitating the poisonous contents of its feeding tubes? Can we hide our baby from the news? The news is as mesmerizing as handsome con men at carnivals peel off the layers to find the devil man's bones. The man always has perfect white teeth, or so they seem. There is no such color as white. The news tells us there is such a color, and we want to believe. Why pray? I ask my one and only. He is so sure, holding his daughter tight, says God is watching over us. Everything will be all right. Lila continues to cough through the service, and her eyes glaze gray, but in the church she is not alone. There are so many babies, black and blue, from trying to get rid of the black coal, ungrowing to nothing, their veins bursting from their tiny heads. The pastor talks about Job, and I want to shoot him. I always do. My husband tells me how wise the pastor is. I want to shoot my husband, too.
Fascinating, fascinating. This is like work at the junction of several formal, like, possibilities. Really interesting stuff. Yeah,
Thank you.
Yeah. What, I mean, it's like flash fiction. It's like prose poetry. It's like, what is it? Yeah.
What is it? I don't know. You know, these categories are ridiculous. I've read anthologies of, you know, prose poems that sound more like flash fictions to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
for sure.
The two are really, there's a muddy, what is poetry is another question that we won't bother getting into. It's really boring. Either it is to your ears or it's not. If you're hard of hearing, you're not going to. I call a lot of these narratives rhythm-driven or poetic fictions, lyrical fictions. Narratives. There's supposedly a difference between narrative and fiction. I'm not going to go into that.
We'll spend the whole program on that sometime.
I don't have anything to say about it. I'll read one more from the Three Holograms. This is quite different. It's character psycho-driven.
Character psycho-driven.
In other words,
this is
a psychological study.
All right.
Not clinically psychological.
Right.
Her hat. She told herself that the loss of the hat was not important, not a significant event. Well, it was a lavender hat that rounded her face to a soft oval hinting of heart. A hat that mollified the too strong blue of her eyes and some said enlightened her recalcitrant smile. She loved it slightly madly for what she imagined it improved, but not for itself. It was only a hat, no longer her hat. Her mother had paid a fortune for it. Where did you first say it, you careless, reckless girl? Her mother asked, not really asking, simply telling the child in her flat voice as always, I told you so, you are not my daughter, where did you come from? Turning back to the mirror, applying her two dark red lipstick to her feathered lips, the upper too scarce and needy. Mother always frowned when she looked at herself as though she wasn't the person she recognized. Mother had lost parts of babies in her womb, and coming out of it, maybe one before this one. The girl felt absently an afterthought. Mother added, I knew you'd lose it just to spite me. You hate me, she told the girl, stamping her feet. But the girl would not cry in visible spaces, that girl, who did not say, I left the doll on the hedge while I was playing with the slow boy down the street. Left the doll in his bed when the worm between his thighs turned red. Left the hat on someone else's head. Who did not say, I left my wedding ring on my lover's nightstand on the beach at 3 after midnight in the clamping muscles of my vagina, who mused to herself, maybe I threw it into the sky and it never came back. No, that was the hat. Or perhaps his flighty penis. I sold your ring, mother said. I never liked the man, but he knew how to keep his money. A pity you lost him, no surprise. Where's that hat? You should wear it. Your hair's a mess. Arrange my pillows, turn off the lights. You will inherit all that I have, that I've kept. Plastic containers and stainless soda pop caps, polyester molds and girdle snaps, your grandmother's diamonds and pearls, my poor sister's baby curls. Turn on the lights, arrange my pillows. Close my eyes, turn on the lights, turn off. My thousands of things glow in the sky. Close me, please, so I can hold them. That was that, the loss of everything. She was a girl with a loose brain that flew off its stem, who thought of oceans at midnights when the sky had misplaced the moon, thought of tossing herself in the water when there would be no light to find herself under waves. Who was a middle-aged woman asking, where did I put mother's ashes? Trying cupboards and closets, nowhere to be found, oh mother, all were bare. Who was a careless, muttering old woman wondering if she had missed something of significance, a passing wonder, no matter, the woman was not important in anyone's life, a passing trifle.
We'll be right back. Thank you. was the very great Sidney Bechet, whose work actually I did not know in any detail. Thanks so much for bringing that in, Carol. That's Sidney's a wonder.
Yeah.
Yep. And now we're going to cut. This is, by the way, you're listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and my guest today is Carol Novak. Here's another of Carol's compositions, this one called Blah Blah.
Blah Blah. Nobody knows why the manatee hurled itself headlong off the curb into the oncoming traffic. Officially, the secret police don't know, though of course one can never tell with them. Obviously, I stopped short the instant I noticed the animal, but I couldn't help tossing the tea into the sky. And when the poor creature fell, it was mangled and inedible. Actually, I recognized it immediately as a mutant side effect of oil spill. Its eyes were lopsided and one ear was missing. And you could taste the oil in the air. Feel it seeping through the intricate loopity loops of your cerebella if you hadn't been lobotomized. So I steered away from the spillage, proceeded along the highway, and met Slow-Mo at a truck stop. No, a pit stop. No, a rest stop. Not that I meant to meet Slow-Mo or anyone else anywhere. I was in the stupid old cockroach-colored car. What the hell, like I should remember the brand name, when it had combustible issues. And I seemed to be fatally entombed in the stale casket, with the three fecocked kids of the waning boyfriend in Louisville Correctional Facility. And those kids had bad, bad issues. They were playing at killing each other in the backseat, screaming to make me deaf and threatening to shoot me with plastic, silver, laser guns. Real, real lucky weapons of destruction. Zap, 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 you're gone. I just have to stop and find a quiet toilet stall. An extemporaneous room of my own where I could bang my ears against a wall of shit so I wouldn't have to bang the boyfriend's fucking car against a useless mountain or steer the Chevy clear across the cliff. And I had to pee off a few cans of Diet Coke anyway. Always good at golf, get it? So, okay, I stopped, so sue me. I decided to meditate, cogitate, ruminate, flagellate, confiscate some soap, and swig a shot or two of tequila I kept in the boot for apparent reasons, but I have to try to avoid crashing with the little shitouts playing shootouts in the car so that Daddy wouldn't kill me in case I survived. Ohms and tequila might do it. I also took some heavy-duty blood alcohol diluter so I wouldn't get stopped and thrown into some stinking clinker. Enough of the fucking and shitting. I was boring me. The kids were boring into me, Greg and Bobby, punk star wannabes with pins in the middle of their tongues and purple neon goo in their hair. Could never get enough sleep or fast food. I occasionally tried to tuck them in at night and introduce them to Salinger, as if maybe they could identify. But those kids always pushed me away. Why and how was I happening to be in this predicament? Stupid adolescent obsolescent question. Old dickhead used to be a better than average technician with the tongue and thrust, and I was in my alleged prime, barely spinning on 30 despite the post-op degrees, JD and MFA. Jimmy Dean, Fukowski, and Kerouac had long ago passed out dead, for Christ's sake. Dickie would have to do. Maybe it was the way the guy's mermaid tattoo danced in the moonlight over Loon Lake and the way his lips curled like a new wave. By 9, he looked enough like Elijah Wood to get me greased. At least I'd had my tubes tied, condition of inheritance that turned out one big fat zero, cause the feds ended up seizing Daddy's assets under RICO, citing nefarious collaborative criminal activities with members of some family in Florida. Daddy knew about Dickie. Worthless trailer park shit, Daddy would spit. Smart-ass DA Daddy who loved to send crims to the frying chair. Capital punishment, did a man. DOA, telephone wires. He always talked too much. the sweet and sour taste of revenge. Mommy was so delighted. I was annoyed because the telephone was out of order for days. Blame me for everything that happened. So go ahead, nothing new. I get out of the pit stop at the rest stop, wade through parking lot hip-hop. Hummers, whittles, Jesus loves, George W. bumper stickers, and a subdued slow hurricane of dour obese women in powder blue and tepid brown walking about the place like zombies. And I see the car is gone. The fucking car with the alienated kids has been abducted by aliens. So I panic. I have breathing issues when I panic, going back to the days when mommy... No, I'm not going into that. Mommy believed in the classics, love it, do it, support. Watched too many idiot TV shows during the 50s, all about classic families who never fought with their legs apart, particularly in elevators. Enough said about my childhood. I walked straight into the food mall, where all these pathetic lardheads named Wendy and Ronald and Colonel and Bud are getting their sustenance for road rage and kill. And I'm skinny, see? Too skinny. I realize almost anorectic despite the density of dark meat in my head. And I'm about to scream if I don't shut myself up. What the fuck am I gonna do? I don't eat enough. I think I'm starving. So, of course, that's when I meet this guy, Slow-Mo. Yeah, Slow-Mo, as in slow-motion fingers, tall and full of sinews. Slow-Mo, standing by a video game in front of the mini Burger King, watching me and grinning like crazy. So I go, fuck you. And he holds up his hands as in, don't shoot. And he says, it's just your skirt, ma'am. It's stuck to your pink panties and back, ma'am. That you might want to know, very sweet panties, coochie-coo. Maybe I don't want to know, I reply. I have more important things to think about, like when my brilliant, psychotic boyfriend's idiot kids have taken the car for a joyride, and what he'll do to me when he gets out of Louisville Correctional Facility, if nobody finds him dead or alive, but especially if somebody finds him dead. So, it becomes a guide to the rescue type of lickety-split thing. He gets on his digital pacifier faster than old John Silver ever got on his horse. Gets some local sheriff named Barney hot on the trail of the cockroach, while we two cruise in Slow-Mo's fancy red car to the nearest roadside bar and wait for word. Apparently there are a dozen cop cars driving in all directions. One of them spots the cockroach with the kids sputtering, almost out of gas. Yeah, both the car and the kids. But I was out with the sunset by that time. At the Sunset Motel. No kidding. Dusty but clean. So according to Slow-Mo, the sheriff asked him, when do you want the kids dumped? So Slow-Mo gave naive Barney the address of the local whorehouse, my Aunt Madame Rose, Slow-Mo said. And we've been together since. Waiting for Dickhead to come out of the can and kill us. But we have super bug spray, and I keep my nails sharp as kitchen knives from home shopping, and Slow-Mo's my hero. But it really isn't my fault about the kids, is it? I have bad, bad issues, too. We're living in the white bread burbs now. I try to love Slow-Mo's designer car and lap up his lines. We spread them out on the IKEA coffee table. Then we make furious sounds that might sound like love if you were tone deaf. But I know Slow-Mo's only a room with a limited view, and I'll be very off one day soon, I think, as long as I can shake my guilt about those kids. Probably have AIDS or syphilis by now. Maybe the plague that's settling in the hoods of the untouchables. I should find those kids. I mean, I know they were hurting when they were shooting each other. No mother, barely a father. But what can I do? I'm only a womanity, temporarily lodged in the universe, trying to swim. I can't help politics, and my severe limitations and my manatee's fish tattoos are jumping around like crazy, and I'm having heavy problems breathing, trying to figure it all out. I'm a mutant, and there's a stinking spill of bullshit all over the place, and I'm stepping in it all the time off the curb.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah. What's your process like, Carol? How do you work?
Me work? I Well, I come up, it depends. I usually start with a concept or an image, a very strong image. I tend to be very visual. And then I just let the image or the concept or both carry me.
Yeah.
And I often end up with a socio-political message. I mean, it's not what I intend to do. It's just that I live in this world. So,
right, right.
I guess it's my background, too, for so many years.
As an attorney.
Right. As an attorney in the real world.
In the actual
world.
As
opposed to academia.
Yeah,
you know?
Right,
And so all the experiences of my life kind of, they come in. But I don't have a direction. I never plot anything, which makes it difficult when you're going to try and write a novel.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. Prose sort of, or, you know, a novel at least sort of thrives on some sort of
narrative. You know.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe or maybe not.
Yeah, depending on.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, right. So this is like about a 9-minute piece, Baba, that we just heard. Yeah. And so what was the composition of that like? How many, did you conjure that up in like a couple of sittings or a month or 10 years? Or what?
No, probably a few sittings.
Probably a few sittings.
And then I revised. I often, not always.
Yeah.
I often go over every sentence, and revision is 7/8 of the law of the piece. So.
Right. And it shows that attention. I mean,
thank you. Yeah, I take away the extraneous. I mean, even in prose, I shouldn't say even in prose. It's I had many years ago. A woman named Rosette Lamont, who taught, I think it was French literature, and who was a friend of Beckett and Ionesco. She told me when I was writing poems in my teenage years, and she told me, never use an adjective unless it's surprising. And,
good advice.
You know, Yeah, because people overuse adjectives.
Yeah, they do.
And then they say, no, never use an adverb, which is a ridiculous rule. I mean, it's so silly, especially if it goes with the rhythm. There's nothing wrong with an adjective. But, I mean, too many of anything is.
Sure.
You know, so I will cut off adjectives. And sometimes I realize that there's an internal rhyme I can easily make. So.
Yeah.
And it just makes this, it makes, I'm very aware of the sound of the piece.
Yeah. Do you perform, clearly you do perform your pieces out loud. I mean, it just seems like a natural medium for you, live performance.
I should say that my father was a musicologist. So I grew up with music in the house. And
the importance
I think
of sound.
That really formed my, you know, comes into my writing process.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
an important part is what I hear.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's clearly the case here. Yeah. Well, let me enjoy another of these tracks of Sidney Bechet, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And today our guest is the amazing Carol Novak. So here's another of Carol's compositions.
On the hill there is an easel holding a painting of a town. You're always traveling to the town, but whenever you think you've arrived, there is nothing but stones, statues, and indigestible bread. You return to the painting. You wonder if there's a detail you've missed, a clue that will help you find the town. You let your eyes be deceived. They are connected to your heart with its longing to nest. You are possessed with owning. You lose your perspective again and again. Wanting perspective, you are cursed. Two. You have come to rest. You think perhaps this is my town or close enough to the one I was walking towards. At least when the moon guided me like a mother it seemed to be. I can't be too fussy. I will die with dust mites and sand crabs and there will be no home in death. But now, always now, this town is different from then. At least my memory of soft greens and blues with gentle angles, or so it seems. This town is all glare with acute turns and sonic booms. It won't hold me, rock me, is neither mother nor lover. It has so few dimensions for me, though it has dimensions for the neighbors, I suspect. They talk about rules, have so many they can't keep track of what's forbidden. Too many of them stay indoors for fear of breaking a rule. The chandelier drops of cameras. They don't understand. They make more rules. This town's windows need insulation in the frigid seasons when the voices grow colder and louder. Nothing grows, and the kitchen shelves are vacant. One can hear the real estate agents screaming in their white rooms. One can see their angry shadows through white curtains. Always white. That is what the denizens want, a neutered town in which you may disappear into your shadows. They say the colors invite a rest. They think they are invisible, the fools. Perhaps they are invisible, and I am the fool. Here again I have to walk on stones for bread. The bakers don't know me, so I will move on. It's not a town. Well, not mine. That is my perspective. Not this. Three. He frightened me when he clasped me to him in the night, when he lowered the volume of his voice to speak of the mirage of walls and roofs. Not so long ago, he seemed to be my destination. He was mine and I was his, or so it seemed. After an orgy of mirrors, we sucked and picked at one another's bones. Then he strayed into that other woman's residence and stayed too long. I took the turn back to where I'd been going, but couldn't find it. Pain was my map. I could hardly see clearly. So I found you hiding in a hedge with thorns. Not crying, but chanting. No, singing. Singing a lament to your mother. You crooned, wanting to crawl back into her. So I came and stroked your head. I remember your hair as soft as dandelion puffs, and you trembled, but kept still for a spell. Entranced, you let me be your home. And then, like flotsam, you floated away. You, with your eyes, danced with storms. I carried on, tore off my red dress, haunted you. Who can stay still? Who can remain in homes with so many rules, you pleaded. I left that town a long time ago, I didn't. At least I thought I did. You looked like a rabbit in a wolf's yellow eye. All homes have rules, you said. You said, I am a nomad. I have no choice. You do, I replied, drawing you into me for the last time.
feeling like the rabbit in your jaws. But was I the wolf? Now I have forgotten your name. 4. In those towns, they lock up the homeless when they remain in one spot and throw stones at gypsies. Like snails, the gypsies carry their homes on their backs. The denizens say, it's not right. Everyone must pay taxes and mortgages like us, despite interest rates. They rape the land we have purchased and pillage the doors we have sown and own. Lock them up. The gypsies say it is a curse to want to own, a curse to be possessed. It is a curse to want to possess and be possessed, a curse to own. You can seek to become the color of any of these towns with their home teams, but the shade will be unbecoming and oppressive, you will see. I try hard not to want, but keep gazing at the painting, as if I had perspective or could learn it. My eyes are connected to my heart with its longing to nest. I can't help but let it flutter its wings and woo my eyes. How foolish. I keep traveling to the towns, all the same cursed towns with their statues and stones. None is the town I seek.
Fascinating. That's a little different than the previous tracks we've heard.
It's very different.
Very different, yeah. That's Destination, and that's from Carol's Inventions to Fictions, Fusions, and Poems. And that one with music by Don C. Meyer.
Don Meyer, yes. He's one of our Mad Hatter's Review musicians.
Uh-huh.
And he teaches at Lake Forest.
Oh, yeah, Lake Forest College. Mm-hmm. Is that where, in Illinois?
You see, just wonderful with that piece. Mm-hmm. And I'm really fortunate that I found such
collaborators. Yeah, I'll say. So how did you collaborate on that? Did you come up with the text first and then?
I did. And I was up in Chicago. I visited, took a trip up there.
Uh-huh.
And I was in his studio, and I think what happened was I recorded the text, and he added the music.
He just came
and
back
that's
and
the way
added,
it is. That's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
And
Is Mad Hatter Review based, insofar as a periodical is based anywhere these days? Is it based in Chicago or is it based in New York?
Mad Hatter's Review is based.
Nowhere, everywhere. Now it's in Asheville,
Now, well, I'm in Asheville.
You're in Asheville, so, right.
The journal, with all editors are all over the place.
Uh-huh.
And we have, contributors from different parts of the world.
Right. How did that happen? How did Mad Hatter's Review come around?
I didn't write for many years, very much at all, and during my lawyering years, and that was, the worst part of 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I started writing again, and I looked at the journals that were, supposed to be so hot,
right?
And I didn't think they were very hot, and I thought they were rather boring.
Yeah,
and I just wanted to do something exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So the first issue came out. It's all online. It couldn't be anything else, really, because it does have the music, unless I were rich enough to do a CD.
Right,
and people would actually buy it.
Right.
Or a DVD, I should say,
nowadays,
with the visuals.
Right, with the visuals.
So every contributor gets his or her works accompanied by visuals, custom-made visuals,
right?
And usually custom-made and custom-made music or audio, or they can also they have the option of reciting their pieces. So,
uh-huh. Yeah.
So we have films, we have all sorts of crazy things. We've got a few features coming up for the next issue, next year or something.
Great. And it's online, too, at Mad Hatter's. Is it madhattersreview.org?
Madhattersreview.com.
I mean, .com, yeah. Madhattersreview.com.
Right now, what you're going to see is an unfinished...
next issue.
Unfinished issue called the MASH issue, which is co-edited with a filmmaker, a new media maven in California.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, it's been going very slowly, but someday it'll all be archived if you don't catch it all now. And we plan anyway to come out early next year, well, at least by March. I hope. And we have some Russian poetry and I think fiction, prose and poetry feature.
Mm-hmm.
We have moving words and we have a visual music feature. So those are three.
Oh, that's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. So when did you start Mad Hatters?
Well, the first issue came out in March 2005.
March 2005.
And it's evolved since then. It's become more complex.
Mm-hmm. Well.
It was also a quarterly. I can't manage that now. It's now an annual.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Sure. Quarterly is.
And it's big.
And with diverse, it works in diverse media, as you say. So, including some from local or North Carolina-based folks like Brian Howe, who's...
Excuse me?
Brian Howe, who's in your MASH...
Oh,
issue,
right.
Yeah, is actually based in the Triangle down near Durham. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a Lucifer Poetics group guy.
Well, we're going to have another submission period if I can keep this up. Donate, please, to my new nonprofit organization, Mad Hat.
Mad Hat. Okay. All right.
Yes.
So how would people go about doing that?
You just go on the site to the sidebars, and there's one that says something like donate.
And you click on that.
And we take PayPal donations.
Excellent.
Or if you're in the area in Nashville or something, you can always figure out where I live and deliver a check. Ask Jeff.
It's not easy to get there. But
that's true.
It's worth the journey. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear something that's really recent that you're working on now. What's up?
Well, what I'm working on now is a collaboration with some kind of a long fiction piece with the infamous Tom Bradley.
The infamous Tom Bradley.
Infamous Tom Bradley, who lives in Japan.
Uh-huh.
And he's one of the most prolific authors I've met. But I won't read from that because we just started. I'm doing the text. He's doing the footnotes.
Okay.
What I have time to read, let's see. I had something here.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 7 minutes. So.
Okay. Something new. And I just had it, but can't find it.
It's being evasive.
Hold on one sec.
Yeah.
Well, I can read a little flash.
Okay.
More recent.
All right.
Okay. This is called quantum physics.
Quantum physics.
And I have no idea what quantum physics means, but it's called quantum physics. Jim and Tim met at the Met. They were scrutinizing a painting of a woman pouting at herself in a mirror as she brushed her exuberant golden hair. Jim looked at Tim and saw Tim as the person he'd always wanted to see in his own mirror, someone who reminded him of himself but substantially more than himself. Tim had the same experience. They looked at one another as though through a magical looking glass and turned instantly into a union. The seeing and the seen, the seen and the seen. Their tastes were naturally similar, from escargot to creme brulee, marisol to clay, and they frequently uttered the same words in unison with glee. Jim had a wife named Adele, and Tim a live-in partner named Estelle. Adele and Estelle took back seats to Jim and Tim and had nothing to say to one another. though they frequently rolled their eyes at each other and yawned in empathy. After a while, the couple outings lost Estelle, who disappeared, maybe with a man named Marvin she'd met at Tango Tuesdays. Adele, a clinical psychologist, declared Jim guilty of a parasitic form of narcissism that would be his undoing. He returned the diagnosis with one swift, impulsive stroke, as people are wont to do when they're rightfully attacked. So Adele left with a child and three cats, and Tim moved in with Jim. Tim and Jim began to grow old together. Eventually, with aging came forgetfulness, fuzziness, cataracts, and grumpiness. They poured into one another's mirrors. They peered into one another's mirrors and spat on the glass, but their images failed to improve and became cloudier. Teeth turned yellow and dropped out. Skin turned the color of ancient bones, and eyes paled. The men threw their mirrors away, but even without the mirrors, Tim reminded Jim of Jim as substantially less than himself, and Jim reminded Tim of Tim as substantially less than himself. And so they became disgusted and hopeless and decided to unmeet. Tim found a woman named Esme, who was more than he'd imagined, and Jim found his son Jimbo, a passable portrait painter.
That is fun.
Well, I'll conclude with something crazy.
All right.
That's actually an audio online at Shimera.
Okay. What's how would they locate the audio there? In terms of a title, or
I think you look at, well, you can go to my blog. There's a link to the Shimera.
Okay.
Chimera. It's an online journal from Australia.
Uh-huh.
And where they don't always take themselves as seriously as the editors here do.
Okay. Oh,
and
anyway,
this is just ridiculous. It's absurd. And I love to write both absurd pieces and satires. So,
yeah. Well, we'll hear some more of those upcoming sessions.
Well, this is totally absurd, and okay. It's not a limerick, but it's 9 foibles about a woman from the left bank of Limerick. And if you do get to that, hear the audio. It has music by my friend Visored Bergenet, with whom I've done a few wild pieces.
Okay.
He's pretty much over the top musically, so. She lived in a house with a louse of a spouse, a louse, with lice in its head and a grouse in its bed. No small wonder she wished him dead, too. She lived in a house, a mousy gray house, and her spouse was a souse, with mice in his head and a louse in his bed. No big surprise, he wished her dead. She lived in a house, but she wasn't a mouse, but she looked like a mouse, a plumpish mouse, and her spouse was a louse, a lard of a louse, as gross as that house. No, he wasn't a louse, he was verily a mouse. But she was a louse, with rice in her head and an old gray blouse, and she killed his pet grouse until it was dead, they said. But you can't believe anyone. Shh. She was a blonde mouse in a grand castle house. Her Moorish spouse was a royal pain mouse, a boorish lound, and so they dwelt. The mouse, that little blonde mouse with flies in its head and that pain of a louse, king louse, with lies in its head. He smothered her till she was quiet and dead. But why? Because she charmed 3 butchers into her bed and felled their heads with one of grandmother's knives. And the bed sheets were full of stains that wouldn't come out. And then the king didn't believe his wife's story about the suicidal grouse and threw a fit because a jealous guy named Egg was planting dark flowers in his head. Well, anyway and anyhow, so it's been said. Proof? Evidence? Into the trap a long time ago. 5. She sat on a couch watching time go by. She sat on a couch watching grouse fly by, watching neighbors wave, hi, fuck you, sweetie pie, bye. Through the blind she would spy with her black navel eye to think she'd cause sighs with her firm young thighs. Ah, youth, sweet youth, when my mouth held a tooth. 6. She sat on her couch watching grouse fly by. She sat on her couch watching mouses with spouses in patriotic blouses. Everyone knew she'd be early to die, early to die. That Reuben S. mouse, she devoured the house and slugged down rye, buttered her thighs and swatted flies. Guess she became a rat, a tat-tat. No, no, not that. 7. She slouched on her couch, eating livers of swine. She slouched and she grouched, drinking cheap rye and wine. And the occasional housefly looking for pie, for pie, for pie, for pie, for pie, for pie. No wonder, small wonder, she was dead when she died. But did she verily die when she died? Or perchance they lied, they lied? You're losing it. You're fit to be tied. Open your twat and in it I'll hide. 8. She died, a lord and a souse in that house, little mouse, little souse, the spouse of the mouse, which couldn't her rouse, her navel did ope, two doves did elope with a clove and some lime, and she was much too tired to rhyme in three-quarter time or half-time, so she timed out full-time from booze and swine. Poor mouse, poor little souse, the laces of her boots did come undone. The end? No, no, mongoose. There was a jury trial of her pairs, and they decided there was unreasonable doubt, and that's how it was when the lights went out.
And that is Wordplay this week. Thanks so much to Carol Novak for coming in. More information, you can get it from naturespoetry.blogspot.com. Back next week.